Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. I was thinking about whether it was too late to say this, but since I haven't seen most of you since last time we met, Happy New Year. Happy New Year and happy winter and happy welcome back. I apologize for having to cancel a couple of programs. What was actually last fall, technically. That's my excuse that we weren't ready for the amount of snow that we had last autumn. But now that winter's here, there are no excuses, so don't expect any leeway there. I'd like to welcome the guests that we have here, and also in particular to welcome a new member, Ivy Biswas. Ivy, if you want to stand up and say hello so everyone can see you. Ivy is with the Community Foundation. She's relatively new to the community, but she's jumped right in and gotten involved in some groups like 40 Below in the Westcott Community Center, so we're glad that she's agreed to join us, and thanks to Kelly Bates to us. We have some guests. What we normally do, for those of you who are new to the roundtable, is after the panel makes its remarks, we'll have a question and answer period. I'll have this microphone to go around and take questions, and again, if you have a question, feel free to raise your hand and make sure I see you, and I will try to get to you. I want to remind you that next week we have another program that was rescheduled from December, and that is Dr. Debbie Seidow from Onondaga Community College. She'll be here next week talking about their strategic planning process, and I know that she'll be really interested in hearing what you have to say or questions that you have about what she presents to us next week. So that will be fun. And we have a full February lineup. I want to remind you also that we are on WCNY-FM on Sunday evenings, and we'll also be posted podcast linked to their website. So if you know of anybody who would be interested in hearing about this topic, again, we're going to be talking today about the changing face of homelessness in Central New York, and to introduce the panel and the topic, is with the Onondaga County Department of Social Services and also a TMR member, of course. And, oh, you're mic'd, so go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Again, I think in front of you are four people that are absolutely passionate and driven on the issue of those that are housing vulnerable and homeless in our community. The changing faces, definitely. I think with the economy, we are seeing more and more homeless, unfortunately, in our community. Just to give you some statistics before I introduce the panelists and give you kind of the format, just want you to have this snapshot of numbers in your head. In a period from October 09 to September 30th, 2010, so 12-month period there, 2,553 people ended up, individuals had to be sheltered in one of our shelters or our overflow, which are hotels in our community. That's individuals. You've got another 747 families that were homeless, had to spend time in shelters. That included 471 kids. So this is there are a lot of people who are obviously very stressed. I think homelessness is probably one of the most stressful lifestyles, if you want to put it that way. And it's ever growing. I think the biggest impact is the economy. In front of you, you've got three experts in the field of homelessness. In my far left is Linda Wright, also a TMR member. She's the current executive director of Salvation Army. Actually, she started there back in 1975. I just want to tell the wealth of experience you have.
Thank
now,
come you.
On.
I appreciate
come
that.
Come on, Linda. She oversees an organization that has over a $14 million budget, over 300 full-time professional staff, and 13 locations within the county. Again, one of the primary missions of Salvation Army is to serve the homeless and housing vulnerable. Next to Linda, it's Mike Malara, who is the executive director of Catholic Charities. He is, he didn't give me any telling data, I mean date, but he just said 30 years of field in human services, but he has had variety of experiences before becoming the executive director of Catholic Charities by working for Onondaga County Mental Health, the State Office of Child and Family Services, Liberty Resources, and before the executive director of Catholic Charities, the executive director of Huntington Family Centers. Catholic Charities' mission also is how do they serve the most vulnerable. Let me just go back to Linda. Linda's going to talk primarily about families and giving you an idea of what the profile of those families and youth that are homeless. Mike is going to talk about single men and single women. And then right next to me is Anthony DeSenza, who just stepped down as the coordinator for the Homeless Task Force. He was doing that for almost 4 years as part of being the facilitator for the Homeless Task Force, which meets monthly. Over 75 organizations are part of that. He also was the lead in submitting what is called the Continuum of Care Grant, which brings in over $9 million annually into the community to deal with homeless and housing vulnerable. Tony works in the Community Development Division of Onondaga County, Housing Program Coordinator. And again, he is going to talk about the community response, at least from a system approach. Again, the task force, the continuum of care, and some of the changes that the national government are looking to communities to adopt. With that, we're going to try to keep them to about 7 minutes, and then we'll have a half hour for questions and answers, which we'll all up here be happy to answer for you. So I'm going to turn it over to Mike to start.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Can everybody hear me okay? Well, good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here. This is my first time presenting to Thursday Morning Roundtable, so I'm kind of taking all this in. It's very exciting to be here. Catholic Charities serves about 25,000 people a year, ranging in age from infants and preschoolers all the way through to senior citizens. We serve people who are in need, regardless of their religious beliefs or backgrounds. If you look at the common denominator across the 25,000 people that we serve, virtually everyone we're working with is struggling with issues related to poverty. We have a number of programs and services that work specifically with folks who are housing vulnerable and homeless, and on an annual basis we work with about 1,000 people that fall into that category. So the first thing we do is try to prevent homelessness, and we have emergency service programs that we can provide to folks. It's everything from rent assistance to utility assistance. These are all designed to kind of help folks stabilize their current housing situation. If someone we're working with does become homeless, we operate two shelters at Catholic Charities. We have a shelter for men, the Oxford Street Inn, and we have a shelter for women and children, the Dorothy Day House. Once somebody enters into the shelter, we work as quickly as we can to get them out of shelter. We have a number of housing and apartment programs where we're able to, in most cases, move folks relatively quickly. And, of course, we partner with Onondaga County and the Salvation Army and many others in that work. In terms of the changing face of homelessness, on the men's side, I can't say that the face of homelessness has changed a lot. There's just a whole lot more faces coming to us every day. If you look at the Oxford Street Inn, even a couple years ago, our average census right at the actual shelter was probably around 90 to 95 men. If you look at where we are over the last year, we're averaging about 111 men at the Oxford Street Inn every night. And then we have actually an overflow shelter that serves another 20 men. So on any given night, we're dealing with about 130 men requiring shelter. What we know is that the economy has certainly had an impact on the men at the Oxford Street Inn, and particularly for seasonal work and day labor opportunities. In the past, we would see a cohort of men that would be able to at least be employed for part of the year or a chunk of the year. But those seasonal opportunities have really dried up, which means that once they come to the Ox, they tend to have to stay a bit longer before they can get back on their feet. On the women's side, we have seen a change in the characteristics of the individuals that we serve. We're seeing more single women without children coming to the Dorothy Day House, and typically they're struggling with a pretty significant mental health issue or substance abuse problem, or sometimes both. And I want to do very quickly a case example that I think kind of represents who we're seeing now at the Dorothy Day House. Back in April of 2010, we received a referral of a woman by the name of Janice. She came to Dorothy Day. Now, at that time, Janice was 50 years old, certified teacher, but she was struggling with very persistent and chronic mental health issues. She was unable to stay employed as a teacher. She ended up moving back to Onondaga County to take care of her two elderly parents. Within a very short period of time, within a year, both of her parents passed away. And here's where we found Janice. She was socially isolated, in grief, struggling with a serious mental health problem. The little bit of money that was made available to her from her family was not managed very well. And before you know it, she can't afford to live in her apartment. So she goes to Onondaga County Department of Social Services. She has to sign up for public assistance. And this is where our single point of entry system is very effective. DSS staff assessed Janice's situation and referred her to Dorothy Day. We began to work with her immediately to first help her get public assistance benefits, help her to comply with all the programs, Jobs Plus, that Janice was very willing to do. In a short amount of time, we were able to help her get a part-time job in retail, of all things. And she worked at took a job at one of the local malls, and we worked very closely with her in our case management program. We also partnered with the Salvation Army on this case and had Janice participate in one of the Army programs that is really a skill-building program to help folks develop the skills that they need to live on their own. Over the summer, we were able to help Janice land her first apartment, an affordable apartment. But our case manager had to do a fair amount of negotiating with the landlord because Janice's credit background was basically a train wreck. So our staff did a phenomenal job trying to convince this landlord and successfully convincing the landlord to take a risk with Janice. So if we kind of fast forward, Janice continues to live in her apartment. She's stable. She went from a part-time position at the mall to a full-time position at the mall. She may never get treatment for mental health. So right now she's saying she doesn't want treatment, and that's really her choice. But she's stable. Our case manager is available to her, and we'll continue to work with her for the next 6 months to make sure that she can maintain her living situation, and we'll be there to help her. And I think for us, it's a real reflection of we're seeing more and more Janices coming into our system and requiring that kind of help from us. So that's a little slice of life of a couple of things that we do at Catholic Charities.
Great. Thank you. Linda.
Great. Thanks, Mike. It's a good to be here this morning, and I'm going to learn sometime not to answer all the questions that are asked of me, because if you don't answer them, then they don't publicly announce them or share them with the world as far as years of service. I'm not sure how many of you would remember what you were doing in May of 1979, but I remember a early morning event that in that year, in that month, where our then county exec, John Mulroy, said that he was a realist. As much as he hated to admit that we had runaway and homeless youth in our community, and we needed to do something about that. And from that day forward, we opened up Booth House at the Salvation Army as a part of a strategy to really deal with the growing numbers of young people with no place to call home. When we try to train our staff and do information sessions in the community about homelessness, one of the things we ask people to think about is, if you had 10 or 15 minutes maybe, and you had one garbage bag, what would you put in that? Because that's about what you have to bring with you if you're going to end up in one of our shelters. As wonderful as our shelter programs can be, it's just not a lot of space. And you can't bring everything that's happened to you in the last 20 years, 25 years, 50 years, whatever that may be. So think about what would you bring in, put in that garbage bag that you might be able to bring with you if you had 10 or 15 minutes to do that before you needed to call us or get to us or be referred to one of our shelters. Not so long ago, I was taking a board member on a tour, a new board member on a tour, and we were at Booth House, and we were touring through, and we get up to the bedrooms, and they had commented that there wasn't a lot of stuff, you know, compared to his own teenager's bedroom. And we looked around the room a little bit, and there was one thing sitting on the dresser. And this one young person, what they put in their bag was their trophy, their basketball trophy. When they had no place to go and they were going to bring what was most important to them was that trophy. There are homeless kids this morning sitting next door to, or next seat over to the young people that you know in our high schools and middle schools. I know my daughter, my youngest is at Janesville DeWitt this morning, struggling in her algebra class. Right next to her is a kid that we serve in our runaway and homeless youth programs at Janesville DeWitt. So I think that when you think about the changing faces, that it cuts across all of our communities as I talk about the youth in our runaway and homeless youth programs. About 40% of the kids that end up at Booth House come from outside of the city of Syracuse, out of in Onondaga County. 60% or thereabouts come from the city in the sense of where their homes were. When you talk about homeless kids and the older kids, and I'll talk a little bit about that program in a second, that's reversed a little bit because it's harder to really nail down where that youngster started at when they became homeless because they've bounced through times before they've gotten to us, which really means they're couch kids. Or the other term that literature talks about homeless youth is that they really talk about them as, and the term is called throwaway. They're throwaway youth that really have no place to be. So Booth House had its beginnings in a very small house that we served well with 8 beds. 10 years later, we added beds to that, had about 10, if you counted the bed that the kids called the runway bed, which rolled up and down the hallway. We had 11 beds, and then in May of this past year, we expanded that program and moved to a new facility with 15 beds for runaway and homeless youth. Booth House's mission is to get kids back home as soon as possible. Our first few years, we were doing that about 70% of the case. Last year, we did that about 95% of the case, getting them back to a stable living, because we know that that family, no matter what, how good we are in our service system, in our shelter system, family is the most important. Not always is that the family member that they left from, but it's some engagement of family. When you are 16, 17, 18, and 19, and probably 20, and you don't have that family, you really then need something longer term than a short-term shelter stay. A number of years after Booth House was opened, that recognition really happened, and with the support of many people, including Onondaga County Youth Bureau, we opened up our older homeless youth programs, or our Barnabas Center and our Barnabas Shelter. So we have another 8-bed shelter for young people that are 16 to 21. And those are really the older homeless youth that would be considered those couch kids or those throwaway kids that have no family to return to. And our focus really there is to learn all the things that I was sent away to college to learn about how to be independent. You know, how to get up in the morning, how to get to the job, how to finish my school, how to take care of myself, how to be able to be independent as an adult. And we're asking 16, 17, 18-year-olds to do that out of a homeless shelter. The youth stay in that program. It's 4 beds for boys and 4 beds for girls for about 3 to 6 months, and it's always full. And when it's not full and there is a bed, because the next kid in line is still on the street, sometimes it's hard for us to find them because of the waiting list, and then we have to go back. So that particular is always full. To share with you a story about, you know, runaway and homeless youth and what they look like in our community, I have to share with you Jessica. Jessica came to Booth House in her junior year and had been really challenged all of her growing up because of her mother's mental health and substance abuse issues. And she got to Booth House, and it was really clear that as a junior, she was not going to be able to return home to this mother, that this mother wasn't able to provide care for her. So she made her transition from Booth House to Barnabas House. During the year and a half that she then really ended up at Barnabas House because she needed to stay that long, she graduated 7th in her class from Fowler. Graduation, we were there. No mom, no siblings, but the staff of our shelter were there. Jessica went from our shelter to Cuca College, on a full scholarship. And Jessica had said to us in an email that she was convinced that her reward for sticking it out was being to look out the window in her dorm. Now, I've never been to Cuca, but to see the lake. Last year, after the first year, she went to Disney, did her internship. I was at Barnabas' house with a tour of another new board member, and I said something about Jessica, and the staff said, oh, yeah, she's coming back because she has 2 weeks between Disney and going to Cuca, and she needs a place to stay, and she's back at the shelter when she goes back to finish her next semester. Families. Okay. How much time do I have? The National Coalition talks about families as being the fastest growing population in our homeless. Children, homeless children, are the fastest growing population in our communities. And that's what we've seen here in Onondaga County, as well as the number of children in our shelter. Salvation Army is able to provide homeless families shelter in any configuration. Fathers and kids, moms and dads and kids, moms and kids as well. The unique thing about homeless families is as we've served them over time, and we've been able to do that shelter service at that level since the end of the 80s, is the number of growing when we see fathers with their kids, men, grandpas taking care of kids, the number of men, single-parent men that are taking care of the kids, that has really changed in the numbers of families that we're able to serve. This past year, we were really challenged with a number of families that had very large families with a number of kids. Our family shelter is set up in individual bedrooms that are multiple beds in them so that you can put a family unit together. And, of course, if you have, you know, a mom and a couple of kids and then there's four beds in that room, what do you do when another family comes and there's only one bed here and one bed there? And it can become much of a puzzle kind of thing. Working with the community support, so we try to fill up every bed as possible, and so that's when those runaway beds come again, or those cots or cribs as we move families around. We've been at 100% occupancy for the last 2 years. We've seen huge increases in the numbers of families, and we also serve single women in that shelter as well as we serve single women at our women's shelter that really need to be in a shelter where there aren't children because of their significant mental health issues. Both shelters have been at capacity in this last number of years. And in April of 2009, we were able to expand our family shelter with the support of Onondaga County to help increase that. And even with that, the numbers of families that are still needing to be moteled in this community is significantly high. You know, when you think about family shelters and you think about the chaos, and we're talking about 45 beds in our family shelter, you think, how safe can that really be and how much confusion can that be? We have served a number of families this year with brand new babies coming straight from delivery at the hospital because when they went in to deliver, they were homeless, and then they came back to the family shelter to parent them and to move them forward. It's a tough row, and we're not always really successful with where we move families too, but it takes a whole community to do that. Once in a while you hear, oh, you know, why would you need Catholic Charities, Salvation Army, the Rescue Mission all doing the same thing? And as you think about hearing our stories, I think this morning, you understand how we fit together as a community, you know, and it's not, we may be all serving homeless people at different parts in their service system with different parts of the population of who's homeless as we complicate it. It's a very complex issue, and we need a very complex system to put that together, and I think we are really blessed in this community to have this type of partnership to do that.
Thank you, Linda. Great. Tony, talk about the community and our system.
Thank you, Sarah, and thanks to Sandra Barrett and the University College at Syracuse University for inviting me to be here, and good morning, everyone. I am here today to share my perspective over 25 or so years on the homeless system, and I want to talk briefly on some of the major systems changes that I've witnessed over those 25 years. And make no mistake about it, HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, they, for the most part, hold the purse strings for many of the services that take place nationwide. And they also, in many ways, set policy. Yesterday, coincidentally, HUD made the allocations, their annual allocations for homeless funding nationwide. We, Onondaga County, was blessed with almost $9 million to be shared amongst 12 community-based organizations operating 40 or so programs for homeless and housing vulnerable in our community. So we pay close attention to what HUD says. Their policies in many ways drive what takes place here on the ground. So I can share with you some of the sweeping changes that I've seen over the years. The first and foremost change that I think will and dramatically change the way services are delivered is as it relates to the focus on the focus away from the bricks and mortar shelter and the focus towards housing. And let me explain to you what I mean. HUD has said that the way to address homelessness, one of the most effective ways to address homelessness is to provide individuals and families a home. They acknowledge that various services are critically important for many people. But ultimately, the way to address homelessness head-on is by doing whatever possible to assist folks in obtaining a home. And the way they say to do that is to provide the right amount of assistance, the right amount of supports to the right people at exactly the right time. And that's the challenge that our local organizations face every day. And they do a good job of providing. I mean, that's all about, that really speaks to efficiency and effectiveness, providing the right amount of assistance to the right individual or family at the exact right time to either prevent homelessness by closing the front door, in effect. And that's being done as we speak today by keeping people from becoming homeless in the first place, by using a variety of strategies that keep people from becoming homeless in the first place, and those that do enter the system to help them to find a place to live, a permanent apartment or a residence as soon as possible, as soon as practically possible. So that's what HUD says should drive our day-to-day work. And so if you can think about, I've seen a graphical representation of the paradigm shift. And if you can think of a wheel with a hub, and in the center of that hub is the prevailing model and the model that we've used much in the past of the shelter. Now, I'm not here to endorse or oppose any of HUD's strategies, any of the philosophies that I'm sharing with you. I'm here to tell you what I've witnessed. And that is, this can be seen in some slides that I have available, but HUD, the model that has been most prevailing over the years is a wheel with the center of the wheel is the shelter, the bricks and mortar facility, and the spokes speak to the various supports that folks need while they're in the shelters. Some folks, supports such as job training, supports to obtain mainstream resources such as Social Security and other supports, mental health supports, with the shelter being the center point. Now, HUD is juxtaposing that philosophy with another wheel, if you will, with housing as the centerpiece, and one of the spokes is shelter. In the event that housing plan falls apart, then the shelter is there to provide a variety of supports, as well as on the other spokes include substance abuse treatment and mental health treatment and assistance in transportation, assistance in acquiring mainstream resources such as employment and Social Security. But the focus has clearly shifted from the shelter to moving to housing as quickly as possible. The strategy is called rapid rehousing by some, housing first by others, but it clearly speaks to closing the front door and moving folks that are in the system out as quickly as possible. And I'll refer to my notes. Another dramatic shift that we've seen as of late is reliance. I'll go back 25 years when I was working in the Martinique Hotel, which is one of the infamous welfare hotels. It's located in Midtown Manhattan, and I worked out of a basement office in a local rectory. And I remember my boss came in one day with a huge box, and she told me that I was getting a word processor. And I was elated because for once I could actually store data. And I couldn't tell you, like, all of my outcomes were in files. They were written in folders, and it would be very difficult for me to articulate the types of outcomes that we were experiencing with the clients that I was working with, let alone what was happening with my colleagues, the success that my colleague in the next office was experiencing. Now, let's move forward 25 or so years. Communities nationwide, including our own, have developed elaborate what's called HMIS, Homeless Management Information Systems, that are simply, they're not simple, they are in many ways sophisticated software applications, and I'll read from my notes here, that they're designed to capture client-level data around homeless needs, the service needs, and the characteristics of adults and children in our shelters. So these homeless management information systems can provide us community-wide information on the degree to which we are being successful in moving folks from shelters into permanency. So we've come a long way. Our HMIS is very robust in our community, and we're really looking forward to making more informed decisions due to the data that we're getting through our HMIS. So HUD is stressing strongly. In fact, HUD mandates that communities nationwide develop homeless management information systems. Another point that I'd like to make is our move locally from a place where individuals could contact shelters directly for access into the system, and we've moved similarly in a similar fashion to New York City and other jurisdictions, we've moved to a single point of access for services in our shelter system. And that single point of access happens to be the Department of Social Services. And a strategy that allows for a single point presumably affords us the ability to document in many ways the extent to which folks are being discharged from public institutions of care into homelessness. It allows for better accountability, and there are a lot of other benefits to having a single point of entry. Obviously, we have the HMIS. That is the single place. The single point of entry is a place where we can capture data on all folks that are entering the system. And I'd like to, you know, give Sarah Merrick credit, along with the Department of Social Services, for engineering the single point of access system in our community. She's done a great job in that respect. HUD in 2008 created some national objectives. HUD is requiring community-wide outcomes in return for their dollars. And I can share with you some of the outcomes that HUD is looking for, some of these benchmarks that HUD is hoping that communities achieve. And some of those benchmarks speak to increasing the percentage of homeless individuals that are staying in permanent housing for 6 months or more. So when these folks move from shelter to permanent housing, there are supports in place, as Mike spoke to, that help to keep folks from returning back into the system. So HUD would like to see 71% or more of families and individuals retaining permanent housing for 6 months or more. HUD wants to see folks, in short, move through the system more quickly, move from transitional shelters to permanent shelters in a more timely fashion. HUD would also like to see communities decrease the number of homeless families. And we have an HMIS in place that allows us to track those outcomes. In closing, I'd be remiss if I did not mention, as Linda mentioned, roughly 6,000 young people. Research shows that young people who run away do not receive supports early in life go on to poorer outcomes and more costly outcomes for the communities in which they reside. As Linda indicated, in the late 70s, New York State crafted some legislation and carved out some funding for runaway and homeless youth shelters. They also created some standards for these shelters. And because they recognized that that in large numbers, young people were crossing, in some cases, crossing state lines, young runaways. So to major metropolitan cities was the term that's used in the legislation. And so New York State carved out some dollars for runaway shelters, and they set some standards. And the first shelter in New York State to receive state certification as a runaway shelter was in a major metropolitan city, Syracuse, New York. And, you know, you'd think that it would have been in New York City or maybe in Buffalo, but it was, in fact, Booth House. And if you do the math, roughly 30 years, roughly 200 young people a year, we're looking at over 6,000 young people who have benefited from the services at our local runaway shelter. And I have the document from the New York State official in our archives in my office, from the New York State official to the county executive at the time, congratulating the community for being the first shelter certified by New York State. And I want to acknowledge, I've seen the correspondence that have taken place on paper between a couple of individuals in this room in order to make that happen. And I would like to acknowledge Marilyn Pinsky and Linda Wright for, they're the blood and the sweat behind that letter and behind the 6,000 young people that have presumably had better outcomes in their lives because of the work that's done in our community. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony. At this time, we'll open it up to questions and answers, but obviously you can tell we're passionate about these people. So, but Sandra, go right ahead.
And I also, I wanted to acknowledge, and the panelists have all said this, that there are other organizations in the community that provide shelters and also, you know, provide services to homeless individuals and families. And but in structuring the panel, you know, we had to make some choices, and the focus being on some of the families and children and the changing policies that we've seen. And again, thank you all for being here. Ed.
Two-part question. The first part is, as Senator just mentioned, there's a lot of organizations that deal with homeless. My question really goes to, how do the homeless find you? I know you're talking about a single point of contract, DSS. Is that just HUD or is it a couple other groups? But a lot of groups out there. How do they find the resources? And the second part is, we all have limited resources, each organization that we talk about. How do you make the choices of who you're going to bring on as part of the 8-bed facility you have, or 11-bed, or whatever it happens to be? Those are my questions.
Well, I can tell you for the youth part, the largest referral source for youth is word of mouth. So it's after 30 years, a youngster that's in need, another youngster, another neighbor, you know, the guidance counselor, somebody knows about Booth House, and it's a word of mouth. After that, it's guidance counselors, school, social workers, and the police department. You know, the violence in the street has not affected us. It is, and police often are a referral source for runaway and homeless youth as far as, you know, helping a young person get to us. And in many cases, then the police feels like they've done their job. Now it's the Booth House and it's the shelter service system that really needs to take over. So that's, on the youth side, that's our major referral source, so that word of mouth and how we connect with the other places where young people are at.
I'd only add that often people who are do not have any financial resources, they end up coming to the Civic Center, the second floor, and talking to people that work in the Department of Social Services. And if they really don't have any housing, we refer them to the 5 shelters that are available. Again, if there's a domestic violence issue, we refer them to the 6th shelter, which is Vera House. But, you know, we're seeing 30-plus individuals a day who are presenting homelessness issues. Also, individuals, they really know where the shelters are. There is a word of mouth. Finally, there is a population. A rescue mission runs something called the HIS team. It's a mobile van, and they go out every night with sandwiches and everything, and they serve those that still refuse to come into the shelters, even in the winter. They reach out and still try to pull them in and get them into the shelters, particularly in these cold nights.
I would agree with what everyone has said. On the men's side, at a place like the Oxford Street Inn, we get referrals, law enforcement, but virtually everybody who comes to us because they've heard about us or have had an experience with us. And at the Oxford Street Inn, our only criteria is you have to be 25 years or older. In many ways, we kind of function as a safety net to the safety net for those folks who just can't, for those men that can't find any other place to stay.
Mike, for the last 4 years or so, I've talked to people who have been staying at the Oxford Inn and who have been able to move into apartments. And 6 months after they've moved into the apartments, they're still there. Can you tell us about that program? Because that's actually getting them out into the community. And many of them are making it once they're there, and they seem to be sober.
Yes. Well, thank you for that question. And they seem to be sober.
So do you, Mike.
And so do I, yes. Thank you. Thank you, Linda. And I was going to pick on you about 1975. So I'm very happy to have our two program directors here, Chris Curry and Carol Schaefer, who oversee our housing services. But the program that you're referring to is really our Housing First model, and Tony mentioned it. And it's kind of counterintuitive when you think about it. But what we endeavor to do in Housing First is take men who are, and women, but primarily men at this stage of the game, who are chronically homeless, who are at the Oxford Street Inn, and with a lot of support, move them pretty rapidly into their own apartment. The counterintuitive part is this doesn't mean that they have solved their alcohol problems, their drug addiction, or their mental health concerns. What we do solve when we move them into their own apartment is they're no longer homeless. And we find that that's kind of a foundation that enables us to really begin to work with them on all those other issues. Now, the HUD standard is, I think Tony mentioned, that folks who move into their permanent housing can remain there for at least 6 months. 71% hit that metric. In our Housing First model right now, we're about 95% of the men that we moved into their own apartment have been able to retain their housing for over a year. So we're very pleased. What's the magic in the bottle? Part of this is tactical in terms of the work that we do, but I will tell you that it's our staff. Our staff are completely devoted to the work that we do with this population and all populations that we serve. But I think it starts with the basic principle that when we work with a homeless individual, we see them as having infinite value and as worthy of they're worthy of dignity and respect. And as strange as that sounds, that's a new experience for a lot of the folks that we serve. And it's in that relationship enables us to try to influence the way that they make decisions in the course of their lives. So our case managers are available constantly, 24/7. When one of our homeless guys who's in an apartment starts to struggle, we're there for them. It's really nitty-gritty, roll up your sleeves and be ready to support this person in any way that we can. And we have found that has been the real magic in the bottle in terms of making the difference. Thank you for that question.
Good morning. I'm thinking about the model that Tony just described with the two hubs and where the center, the old model is the center, is the shelter itself, the new model is housing. And while I totally believe that you're all about the permanent housing and getting roots for people, I also know how organizations build up around the vision, and I wonder if there are any tactics or strategies that you're struggling with so that you can get yourselves further towards the permanent housing model.
I would just say, just to get started, during the 80s we built some shelters and did the emergency shelters, but for almost 20 years we didn't expand the shelter beds. Our whole community's focus was on permanent housing. Housing was supports, aftercare supports. Up until this last economic thing where we increased our family shelter beds, and I think the Rescue Mission had also just prior to that increased their men's shelter beds. Our shelter system, in the sense of the numbers of beds available, we had really controlled. And our whole priority as a continuum of care, as a homeless task force, was on the next step, the housing. When it was clear that if we didn't serve them in our shelter system, they were going to end up in less favorable situations as far as housing, including motels where there weren't services and supports. That's when the community came back together and said, we have to do something about building capacity as it relates to our shelter. The only thing that's different than that in the sense of shelter capacity is youth. We opened up Barnabas House in the sense of the expansion of that in the early 90s. We could double that without any problem and fill it up. And the reason I'd asked this question, I didn't really respond to it, for those 8 beds for older homeless youth, the only reason we don't have those 8 beds for more 8 beds for older homeless youth is we don't have funding for it. Where there's just not, as all the needs we have and the limits in the federal resources that we have as far as prioritizing, there's just not enough money to do a Barnabas 2 as it relates to that older homeless youth support, but we could use it.
I would just add to that, I think one of the struggles to achieve that, you know, permanent housing status is just the availability of affordable and decent housing in the community. The housing stock, and particularly on the rental side, is a mixed bag. And the way we've tried to accommodate that particular challenge, when we went into Housing First, we actually developed a crew of essentially carpenters and maintenance staff that when we are able to find appropriate apartments, we actually do some of the renovation work to get the apartments up to a particular standard. But that's one way to approach the problem, but it's housing stock that sometimes gets in the way.
Yeah, and that the exit strategy is apartments. And affordable, a single person whose only income is public assistance, you're talking about $325 a month is what they live on. So our challenge is to figure out what's affordable, safe, and in many of these cases, these are people, as we've been describing, they have complex backgrounds, so they need to have probably some ongoing support services. So with that little bit of money, how are we going to build these exit strategies? We, Mike and his agency have come up with some creative ideas, but we need hundreds and hundreds of those, and that's going to be our challenge in the next few years.
How do you handle people who are uncooperative or do not seek shelter in sub-freezing weather?
In addition to what Sarah had mentioned about the his van, which is part of the rescue mission, and the rescue mission also has a drop-in center, you know, a place for during the day, the Barnabas Center also has a street outreach van and street outreach workers for youth. So we go where there may be kids and corners, talking to them and making sure that they have a place to stay tonight. And if not, can help transport them to one of our youth shelters, Booth House primarily, if they're under the age of 18. So that, you know, it's being in the street. I think his team van has been on the road for, you know, since the late 80s. You know, they have been the arms and legs of in the streets, you know, under the bridges, you know, trying to engage what we would consider the chronically homeless folks that are really what the myths are as far as who's homeless. And they are a population of them, but they're really small comparison to the full numbers of who the homeless population is. I don't know. You want that?
Adults in the state of New York have free will, so we can only do so much. And that's why that we have the outreach teams. And again, it's relationships, relationships, relationships. And usually the relationships bring people into the shelters and start the process of ultimately getting them to permanent housing. But you're allowed to live, you know, sleep under a bridge.
Outreach is meeting folks where they are and attempting to develop a trusting relationship. I think that's what underpins good outreach efforts.
I wonder if any of the panelists can respond to this. The YMCA has about 90 rooms down under downtown facility. How does that fit into the total picture that you're describing?
It's permanent housing, primarily for folks that have been through our shelter system. You know, it's independent, you know, housing, SRO types of settings, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so it's part of this whole continuum that goes everything from street outreach you know, on the corners to permanent housing, and including permanent housing with supports. And I would say the Y fits that permanent housing with supports model, and it's men only, correct? Adults, men only.
Yeah, critical. We would be in.
Well, you know, we shouldn't acknowledge, too, that the other, you know, player we've talked about a lot is the rescue mission, and we couldn't ignore the fact that the, you know, the beginnings of the rescue mission's amazing work in this community started with, under Clarence Jordan's leadership and what they've developed in services to the homeless. So we should recognize Clarence as a lifelong TMR member as well. We should. I don't know how we didn't do that up front.
Hi. Another group that you haven't mentioned is veterans. And I'd like you to talk about, you know, people see someone standing by the 690 with the sign, homeless veteran, give me some money. And I think what you're describing is what, you know, that there are services, and veterans particularly, but for, you know, a homeless person doesn't have to stand there asking for money because there are services.
If I may, I often respond by saying that the wide majority of homeless people do not all panhandlers are homeless, and the wide majority of homeless people do not panhandle. Representatives from the Veterans Administration yesterday at the Common Council Homeless Task Force announced that they've been successful in providing permanent vouchers for permanent housing for veterans to a significant degree, and there have been made available to veterans resources that at significant levels as of late. So there's been some good work done with this population.
Just one more on this, and I really appreciate the question. On the men's side at the Oxford Street Inn, we have a very close relationship with the VA. We have VA staff that spend a portion of their work week at the Oxford Street Inn working with veterans that are seeking shelter with us. And it has enabled us to develop some collaborative programs to move veterans from a state of homelessness, at least at the Ox, and I think this is also true at the rescue mission, into permanent housing. So there is connective tissue across these programs and services on behalf of veterans. But thank you. That was a great question. Thank you.
You've spoken a little bit about mental health. What about medical health? How do you address that, and do you follow up on medical problems that the homeless have?
At the Oxford Street Inn, we have access to nursing staff that are there at least once every week to assess the men, particularly for tuberculosis, because of those kinds of communicative diseases that can exist there. From there, we can make referrals. If they're connected to our housing services with a case manager, we can assist the homeless in terms of getting their medical care needs. They don't always avail themselves of those choices and options. Again, that, you know, why wouldn't they do that? Well, part of it is free will, but part of it is, at least for a subgroup of men that we work with, because their mental health issues and substance abuse and alcoholic issues are so pervasive, quite honestly, their thought process isn't working very well. You know, they're not thinking very well, and they're not always making the best choices. So even in those situations, we continue to make service available, and hopefully they will avail themselves of it.
I was going to say, the other major partner for the Salvation Army with our Women's Shelter program, and I know this, they share time with the Rescue Mission as well, is the CHANCE program, which is a partnership with St. Joseph's Hospital. So they bring on-site psychiatric social worker and a nurse to help us with diagnosis of both health as well as mental health supports, for really trying to do an alternative to folks having to go to clinics for that kind of medication and support. St. Joseph's has been a great partner. We've been doing that with the support of the County Mental Health Department for a really long time, you know, probably almost 20 years with supports to do that's really alternative to getting care for homeless people.
You spoke a bit in the beginning about what your demographics look like as far as men with families or single men with children. I was just wondering if you could speak to what the racial demographics look like as far as your intake. Is there any trends, or if it looks different in the city than maybe some of the folks in the county that you're seeing?
But the family shelter serves all of Onondaga County, which would be true for any one of our shelters. But the majority of the families that come to us are from the targeted inner city neighborhoods where poverty, you know, and the economic stresses are the majority of the issues. So, you know, you can think about those areas in our community where south, near west side, in the sense of the population. The actual demographic breakdown, this is Liddy Hentz, who is the director of all of our emergency services at the Salvation Army for our adult system. The racial breakdown of families, do you know that off the top of your head?
Actually, since I'm mic'd, Liddy, although provided me the data. In that time period, where that 12-month time period for families, 55% indicated that they were black or African-American, and 27% indicated that they were white, non-Latino, and then all the and then various smaller percentages for other ethnic groups, races. If you look at the individual side, the numbers don't really change too much. 44% black or African American, 39% white, and again the balance. So that's what you're looking at, the makeup of individuals and families.
I was curious, and I'm not sure which of you can perhaps answer this, with the children in particular, the families with children, and I'm guessing that they might have to be moved away from their neighborhoods and away from their neighborhood schools. How do you deal with getting the children to their schools, or do they have to move schools, or how does that work?
They have a right to attend the school that they came from with a act called the McKinney-Venta legislation, right, Tony? Which means that the school district has to provide busing. So if it's a young person in the youth shelter and they go to Baldensville, Baldensville has to make arrangements for that young person to get back out there. If it's a family in our family shelter and the children there, the school district has to stop at the family shelter and get them picked up, those children picked up and transport. And that's a responsibility of the school district to do that. It's not always easy. The child could choose to change schools, to go to the school where their shelter is located if it's a different school, you know, a quadrant, or if they choose to. That rarely happens. It's really important for the youth population, as you can imagine, to try to stay them connected to the school. And in addition to the fact that they get to go to school as a right as a homeless child or homeless youth, the district actually provides us homebound instructors on site at the shelter as well for our youth who are not connected in school, or for whatever reason, it's been a long time since they've been there and need some supports as we sort of assess what the best educational program is.
It's important also to note that these protections that are extended to students in homeless situations by the McKinney-Vento Act also are extended to young people that are in doubled-up situations. The homeless definition under federal education law defines a homeless youth as it's broader than the HUD definition. A homeless youth under the federal education law includes those that are doubled up. So that if my friend's son, if you will, is at my home but attends school cross town, he or she is entitled to continue his or her educational experience seamlessly at the school of origin.
I just want to revisit something you touched on earlier, and that's the people who are at the intersections and on street corners asking for money. Do you know who they are?
There was an effort, yes, in short. I maintain that the majority, most homeless folks do not panhandle, and many who panhandle are not homeless.
Entrepreneurs, yes. Right. Someone said that. just leave it. I think the city police department has a pretty good handle on those individuals, but I don't think we can really tell you for certain who those.
Linda Wright, Mike Malera, Tony DeCenza, Sarah Merrick, thank you all for being with us here today.